playback on RT Radio 1. Sponsored by the all-new Irish Times Weekend. With new writers like Marion Keyes and Sean Moncrief, your weekend's in good hands.
Good morning. In a very fractious week of Tory and Trumpian turmoil, let's hear it for a good news story from Thailand. And didn't your heart just soar as the last of the Wild Boar football team and their coach, trapped for 18 days in an underground cave in northern Thailand, were finally rescued against all the odds? An incredibly dangerous operation in rising monsoon waters by expert international cave divers, and it was touch and go right up to the end. The boys and their coach are now recovering in hospital, exhausted both physically and emotionally after their ordeal, but happy. Channel 4's Asia correspondent Jonathan Miller has reported from the mouth of the cave since the operation began. He spoke with Mary Wilson.
When we remind ourselves back a week ago when they were still considering leaving the boys in that cave for 4 months because they believed it was next to impossible to try and teach them the basic skills they were going to need to dive and swim and get out of that cave. And then everything changed.
Yeah, I think the change came for two reasons. And one was there were plummeting oxygen levels. The depleted oxygen was very dangerous because normally the air we breathe is 21% oxygen, and it had gone down to 15%, below which you begin to get signs of what's called hypoxia. And it's a bit like altitude sickness, where you start feeling a bit drowsy, then a bit nauseous, then your brain doesn't function very well, and then you lose consciousness. Now, it's possible that if they had decided that the dive out was just too dangerous and that they would just leave the boys down in that chamber for the next 4 months until the monsoon rains recede, it's possible that the oxygen levels wouldn't have recovered and the boys would have died. They had a window. They took the chances while they could, and they performed this miracle of training these 12 little boys how to use scuba gear inside a week. And these were kids, most of whom didn't even know how to swim. It is an absolutely astonishing story against insuperable odds.
Well, one of the divers involved in that miraculous rescue is Jim Morney, a Belgian who's been living in County Clare for the past 15 years. He arrived back home from Thailand yesterday morning.
Are you happy to be home?
Very happy to be home and back to Russia and my dad and all my friends. I can only imagine how worried they were. I was worried too. I'm very fortunate to have been able to do this. But the true heroes are those boys that endured way more. They endured way more than us. And very happy.
Do you feel your life is at risk at any time, Jim?
No, cave diving and caving is something I do on a weekly basis. It is a highly dangerous activity, but that's why we train and we're at it for so many years that we're able to manage the risk. Even now, as you can see, we're able to manage the risk and the stress, and on top of it, add the huge responsibility to bring those boys out, which was not an easy feat. We really didn't expect that it would be such a good outcome. We were focused right until the end, until the last people were out of the cave, and then everybody was happy, very happy, of course.
We heard, Jim, about very narrow passages, about two foot wide in places, and the arduous task of getting gas cylinders and oxygen cylinders through those. Mm-hmm. Just how difficult is that compared to conditions that you'd experienced before this?
It just became more difficult because of the added responsibility of having a human life attached to you, and of course the physical size of the boy.
Were the boys aware of what was going on? They were sedated when they were being brought out, but before they left where they were for a couple of weeks, were they aware of what was happening?
Yes, they were well aware of what was happening, and it took quite a while to formulate a plan, but once we had a plan, it moved quickly out of necessity.
It moved quickly out of necessity. Local hero Jim Warney speaking to reporters at Shannon Airport, among them RTE's Pat McGrath. Well, Prince Harry and his wife Meghan Markle escaped from the Brexistential crisis and paid a 2-day whistle-stop tour to Dublin earlier this week. And they certainly packed a lot in, with visits to an Taoiseach at government buildings and President Higgins at Áras an Uachtaráin. There was a bit of history and culture too, and of course there was lots of glitz and glamour. On a sunny Tuesday evening, the royals attended a garden party at the British ambassador's residence, and like his granny before him, Prince Harry had the coupe le focle to charm the invited celebs.
Tonoshta, ambassador, Gwiniushla. Did I get that right? Standing here with you on this beautiful evening, it is easy to see why Ireland has such a special place in the hearts of my family and indeed all those who come here. We're so pleased to be here for our first official international visit together as a married couple, and we hope it will be the first of many.
RTÉ's Diane Connor got the golden ticket to mingle with the in-crowd, among them Vicky Phelan, the woman who exposed the cervical check scandal. She was one of the first guests to meet the royal couple.
Actually, Meghan said that she knew who I was, which I thought was amazing. She said, yeah, I've been following your story. I went, oh my God, you know. I mean, look, people knew about me elsewhere, but you still don't think the royals watch anything like this, you know. And she just said, you're doing great work, keep doing it. And I said, yeah, well, don't worry, you know.
Other well-known faces included Brian O'Driscoll and Amy Huberman.
Couldn't believe hearing that Harry'd never been before, so we're just talking about life and a bit about Irish rugby, and then I asked him, was it coming home? I don't think he was as confident as the rest of the English nation, which seems excessively confident, but maybe that's just his humility.
Harry had come and spoken to us, so we had good fun with him, and they were lovely. Yeah, I think it was all really relaxed, really nice, so it's been a lovely evening. Anya from IFTA, who had introduced us, had said that I had been at the royal wedding, but I think there was a look of panic on his face, and I said, well, it was not your one. It wasn't yours. I think he looked at me and was like, I don't know who you are, because so if you were at a wedding, you gatecrashed it.
Ibrahim Halawa was also amongst the 300 guests.
It was a great evening, of course. I had the privilege of being invited here, of course, after such a hard experience, and just seeing the couple together was so beautiful, of course, and so heartwarming, and somehow we can reach a connection between both countries.
Diane Connor reporting for Wednesday's Morning Ireland. Well, the Queen of Athlone herself, former Fianna Fáil Education Minister Mary O'Rourke, was another person keeping a close eye on the royal visit. She was cruising down the Shannon with Ray Darcy as part of his Ireland's Hidden Heartlands tour.
You didn't get an invitation to the British Embassy last night to visit Meghan and Harry, did you?
No, I did not. I wasn't a VIP or a VVIP.
That's the new one. Did you hear this? The VVIP now.
Yeah,
seemingly they're VVIPs.
That's right.
Would you be a VIP or an IP?
Neither.
Just a P.
But I loved looking at the pictures today, and I'd be really interested in them. You know, people say, oh, I wouldn't be bothered going to see them. So, what's harm in looking at them and talking about them?
I'm sort of conflicted. Why are we making such a fuss about them at all? To me, and maybe I'm just being a pain in the behind, but it's like 24 hours of condescension. You know, we're tapping hands.
I don't think she's like that at all. And I don't think he is either.
Right, okay.
I mean, he has known a lot of tragedy in his life, short as it is. And I think they're just a young couple in love and coming to visit Ireland.
And they're celebrities.
What's wrong with
they're
that?
Celebrities,
and they
yes.
are celebrities, yeah.
But I suppose they're celebrities, but they have the logistical backup to organise these parties.
Oh, I know.
And corral people into pods and all that sort of thing. Did you hear that? Everyone's corralled into pods. There were themed pods. So they had the health and mental health people, then they had the sport people. So as they went along last night... They knew, yeah, it's health, exactly. And then they could switch. We're switching to sports now. Now we're switching to arts.
We're carping now. I think I call that carping.
Yeah. I enjoy a bit of carping, though.
An odd time.
Yeah. We have to. It's in our nature.
I suppose it is.
Ray Darcy with Mary O'Rourke. Well, fashionista Evelyn O'Rourke was also on the royal beat. Herself and Mary Wilson went a little bit off the rails on Drive Time.
It is about that glamour and sparkle, isn't it? People loving to get a glimpse.
Yes, she was dressed in that dress. Whether it's moss green or olive green, Mary, you'll have to decide yourself. But we do know it's a Givenchy design dress. Claire Wade Keller is the head designer there. And they, of course, created the wedding dress. So obviously that's an ongoing relationship there.
Evelyn, is it wrong of me to ask, what's Harry wearing?
No, Mary, because earlier today we got photos of them at celebrations for the RAF centenary, and Harry's wearing his full military gear. No surprise, I suppose, that he changed, and what we saw him in this evening was kind of a blue suit, smartly attired, as was the Taoiseach, of course, no rolled up sleeves here.
Evelyn O'Rourke reporting for Drive Time. Well, Harry and Meghan flew back to the homeland on Tuesday evening to watch the semi-final of the World Cup. But despite all the dreaming and the hoping, England crashed out to Croatia. And football will not be coming home after all. It's coming home. Well, over on Second Captains last Saturday, when England's dream was still burning bright, comedian David Baddiel, who co-wrote that anthem, England's Coming Home, was asked the big question.
Do you get the sense that this is a moment of collective joy, that the country has come together in some way? What has been a very divided country over the last few years can experience, for the first time maybe in 3 or 4 years or longer, can experience the same moments in the same way and all feel part of some sort of a community?
Who knows about that? I mean, one would hope so, just to sort of put a slight damper on that, but I thought it was funny. Nigel Farage tweeted after the Colombo game, "Hey, how great, maybe it's coming home." And Satnam Sengar, I don't know if you know him, he's a very good journalist, writes for the Time, said something like, "Shut up, you complete charlatan. Most of those players' parents would not be in the country if your politics had their way." You know, so none of them would have come here, and I think that's true. So, you know, I wouldn't say that all rifts are going to be healed by the England team and football's coming home.
David Baddiel. So, all eyes on Moscow tomorrow afternoon when the Croats will square up to the French. Over on Liveline, Joe Duffy caught a serious dose of World Cup fever when he spoke with Croatian supporter Zarka Stokic.
Zarka, well, congratulations again to you.
Thank
and
you.
Your fellow countrymen and countrywomen. It's a fantastic achievement. Get your voice back for Sunday in the living room in Dublin, because you're going to need it. Above all, enjoy it in your native language. Would you wish your team well and also call on people in Ireland to support them? You can do that to sign off, Zarka, if you would, please.
Okay, I will. Go. Thank you, Joe.
Well, and I want energy, please, Zarka, in your next few words. Off you go.
Okay, thank you. Ubój za narod svoj, ajmo Hrvatska za pobjedu! Thank you, Joe.
Thank you, Zarka. I'll take your word for it. Come on, Croatia!
Thank you.
From Liveline with Joe Duffy on Thursday. Well, no doubt our football crazy president will be glued to the game tomorrow. And there was no great surprise on Tuesday when President Higgins announced that he wants a second 7-year stint in the park. But it's unlikely to be a coronation, with several candidates already limbering up to challenge him. In Mayo, where he declared his intention to run again, President Higgins was asked about the idea of a sitting president going out on the campaign trail and how he'd balance being president with campaigning.
I think it's a very fair question, because it's something that hasn't happened before. On the last occasion, it was President De Valera. His opponent was Tom O'Higgins. Things are very different, but I have had the opportunity of legal advice and legal opinion. Let me say straight away that the reason, for example, I'm making this announcement in the way that I'm doing it is that I'm separating it from my work as President of Ireland, which of course continues. I have many obligations, commitments into which I've entered. There are people who've made appointments to come and see me. All of the work at Áras an Uachtaráin will continue. And therefore, if it comes to it, then when I'm organising a campaign, that will be organised separately from Áras an Uachtaráin. Of course, it isn't a usual circumstance, but I'm approaching it, I assure you, with a sense of robust energy.
President Michael D. Higgins. Well, that topic was also discussed by political commentators David Avenpower and Justine McCarthy, who spoke with Mary Wilson.
Let's go back down the road of history to 1966, when President De Valera at the time, did he sit in the Áras, let O'Higgins go out on the campaign trail and not go out himself to actively engage with the people? David?
Yeah, he did. And what Michael D. Higgins said there is significant, because he said he will be campaigning. Mm. But what happened in 1966 was extraordinary in a way. RTÉ television was in its early days, but was basically the only show in town. Sitting President Éamon De Valera, as you say, didn't campaign, and then prevailed upon RTÉ, since he wasn't campaigning, not to cover the campaign of the Fine Gael candidate Tom O'Higgins. So there was essentially no coverage of a very vigorous campaign which Tom O'Higgins put in. O'Higgins actually lost by less than 1% in 1966, and with some justification, his supporters said that had RTE taken another view, or Televisieren as it was then, that he would have been in the Oras. Now, perhaps Michael D's aides toyed with the idea of invoking that precedent, but I think in this day and age it wouldn't get very far in RTE.
Can I ask the age question? It has been raised already in speculation around Michael D Higgins running again, because he is now in the second half of his 70s. He'll be into his 80s in a 7-year term. Is that a question he'll need to address if there's a campaign, Justine?
I don't think so. I think he addressed that in 2011, and he has shown that it has been no handicap to him. And in fact, I think he's looking nippier now than he looked in 2011. I don't see age as being a problem at all for him.
Justine McCarthy and David Davenport. Well, putting your name forward for a presidential election is not for the meek and mild. Past campaigns have been vicious and personal, with some reputations torn to shreds. But undeterred, a number of senators have already expressed an interest. Brian Lally, armed with a portfolio of photographs, got a reaction on the streets of Dublin.
Can you tell me who that person is?
No.
Can you tell me who that lady is?
No.
Can you tell me who the gentleman on the bottom is?
No.
Well, there are three of the people that are being talked about as potential presidential candidates. That's Padraig O'Cagey, that's Joan Freeman, and at the bottom there, Senator Gerard Cowell.
To be honest, I'm very fond of Michael D, so I think he does a great job. So I would be, to be honest with you, I think he does such a good job, and he's been very successful for Ireland, and has good ideas, and he's also got good approach to doing things and getting things done and looking after people and trying to make things better for Ireland. So I think it'd be good. He'd get a great endorsement if he does. If it goes to an election, he'll just show you how much I think how people regard him. I think it'll be a huge boost for him as well. I think he's up there with the best of them, you know.
Do you know who that man is there now, that picture?
He used to be that owned Air Ireland. Can't think of his name.
You're absolutely correct. Padraig O'Cagey, Senator Padraig O'Cagey. Okay. What about the lady in the middle there? Would you know who she is?
No.
And the gentleman on the bottom?
He looks like an Irish farmer or something like that.
The lower two are Senator Joan Freeman and Senator Gerard Crockwell. They have been kind of rumoured to be interested in the presidency. Should there be an election?
I think he's done enough. Yeah. I think it should be someone else should be allowed. He was good and is good, but I'd like to see other people get a chance.
What about that, sir? Would you think there should be a contest for the presidency?
Oh, certainly, yeah. Yeah. Has to be.
Nobody should get a job automatically.
Should have happened to Valera, remember in 66, was it? He only won by 1%. I think he'll have a Sinn Féin, won't you?
It looks as if Sinn Féin might put someone up, all right, and there might be one or two more in the ring as well. You wouldn't object to an election anyway. You think it would be a good thing?
It'd be a very good thing, yeah.
Brian Lally reporting for Drive Time. President Donald Trump has been cutting up rough in Europe this week, first in Brussels, doing what he does best, rattling the cages on the political and diplomatic front. He arrived in Britain on Thursday, and it didn't take him long to lob a grenade at Prime Minister Theresa May over her handling of Brexit. Fine Gael MEP Brian Hayes and Shona Murray, foreign correspondent of the Irish Independent, discussed the fallout with Miriam O'Callaghan yesterday.
Look, it's been another week of turmoil in British politics, probably the most anarchic few days since the Brexit vote itself. Do you think the negotiations have been damaged by the resignations of Boris Johnson and David Davis and today's extraordinary intervention by Donald Trump?
The two resignations of Davis and Johnson have actually helped the negotiations, because we now have a British position. We have a British Prime Minister who's now known what she wants 2 years after she triggered Article 50, or close to it. And I think from the Europeans' perspective, we're going to hunker down now and see if we can get some deal. So I think she's actually had a very good week, because she stood up to at least 40% of her own parliamentary party and said, this is what I want. I'm going to defend this deal that virtually they all agreed last Friday, this time last week, and then by Sunday, Monday, some of them moved away from. So she has to do two things. She has to hold on to that position to defend it and get into serious negotiation with the European Union. And secondly, I think she needs to reach out to the British Labour Party, because ultimately there is a majority of MPs who want a softer Brexit than was there at the time. So I think from Ireland's perspective, we've got to welcome what she has done. Obviously, our negotiations with the European Union. But I think the intervention of Trump has been extraordinary. For him to select the Sun newspaper to launch this grenade into the debate and to undermine her, as he's done with every other ally in the last 7 days between Angela Merkel and Trudeau, has just been extraordinary. He wants to cause as much disruption as possible. It's payoff time to Farage and others who backed him. And his worldview is to do everything he can to dismantle the European Union.
First of all, Shona Murray, Theresa May, you have to admire her right now, even like this morning, keeping going, having to meet Trump today.
Yeah, there's probably nobody, no Western leader that has suffered as much public humiliation as Theresa May has from all sides, from Brussels, where she has been seen as quite weak. Also, the fact there's been so much sneering, mainly because Brexit, by its very nature, the objectives are irreconcilable. You can't have this type of global trade policy that they want and stay aligned to the single market, which is actually what Donald Trump was actually saying today. And he's completely right about that. She had to eventually betray somebody, which was going to be, you know, David Davis and Boris Johnson, mainly because their view of Brexit is a fantasy. And second of all, because of the obligations that she has under the Good Friday Agreement. And then mostly because the EU and the UK's relationship is much more lucrative than so-called global Britain going abroad, trying to do trade deals with the United States at a time of extreme protectionism in the United States and, I suppose, a lot of global disorder. So it all makes sense. And I do think so far, as we speak now, because things change so often, she is quite strengthened and she does deserve a bit of support. And like, even though the white paper released yesterday, there are so many inconsistencies in it, contradictions in it, cherry picking and cake talk. It still path to something a little bit more pragmatic.
Shona Murray and Brian Hayes heard on Today with Miriam. Well, it's 18 months since Donald Trump was confirmed as president, leaving a shell-shocked Hillary Clinton in his wake. Hillary, you'll recall, started out believing that Trump's candidacy would be a gift from heaven. Well, New York Times journalist Amy Chozick spent 577 days on the campaign trail with Hillary, and her book, Chasing Hillary, gives us a ringside seat at what she calls the most noxious, soul-crushing presidential campaign in modern history.
We bring ourselves then, Amy, to election night. Mm-hmm. There was a sense right up to the wires, watching the final year. I don't know if you've seen that documentary and Samantha Powers having a party for all her friends, as so many people did to welcome the first female president of America into the world. And then it's about 9:30, I think, local time. You could see flowers wilting. And
yeah.
Where were you?
So I'd sort of throughout the general election told my editors it doesn't really feel like a winning campaign. I'd covered Obama in 2008 and those crowds felt like the swell of history.
Joyless.
Yeah. I thought this is just how Hillary wins, you know, because the data had showed that she was going to win. But for a while I had told my editors, I don't know, there's just not energy. But I will say in that last 24 hours, the crowds were huge. You finally felt like this is historic. Yeah. We're going, like, the country's going to elect a woman.
Katy Perry and Beyonce. And they were all out.
They
Stevie
were all
Wonder
out.
And Bruce Springsteen.
Bon Jovi was on the plane with her. I mean, people say that this was, you know, the cynics roll their eyes, but I saw she and Bill Clinton cuddling at the front of the plane, popping champagne. So it was finally, the campaign felt joyful. It felt like a history-making moment. I went to vote with her in the morning in Chappaqua. It was a beautiful fall day. And then we went to the Javits Center. And as you said, it was just felt like jubilant. People were ready for a party. They had the Javits Center is this, you know, convention center under a glass atrium, and they had ordered 1,000 pounds of confetti shaped like shards of glass,
so that the
glass ceiling could shatter down. And the stage was in the shape of the U.S. and it just looked perfect, you know, stage produced and amazing. And then of course throughout the night the mood just disintegrated to the point that it just felt like a mass funeral.
And then everything changed.
Just everyone just shell shocked. Yep.
From the Ryan Tuberty Show. Well, Galway is always hopping, but especially at this time of year, as the film Flow winds down and the Galway International Arts Festival kicks off. The multi-award-winning writer Enda Walsh is a regular at the festival. He was Keelan Shanley's guest last Sunday, and he told her about his latest theatre installation, Office 33A.
I suppose for you, work isn't necessarily about being linear, about telling the story. It's about creating an atmosphere. It's about bringing people into that atmosphere and allowing them to explore.
I think that for me is theatre. It needs to be sort of complex and sort of strange in its own sort of particular sort of world. And, you know, I mean, television can do the whole sort of linear thing, and we can find sort of like box sets, and they can do all that. They can look after that sort of A to Z of sort of story, which I adore. But my instinct always is to make things just a little bit more sort of, you know, trickier for an audience, I think, and a bit more sort of like unusual and sort of abstracted a little bit.
You've a production now, Office 33A. It's part of your Fifth Room series. It's going to be part of the Galway Arts Festival.
Yeah.
Tell us a bit about this.
Oh, well, I turned around to Paul five years ago now, and I said, I've got this idea for a room, and what about building an actual sort of room? And you walk in, and from the outside it looks like a white cube, and you walk in and you're in a very, very naturalistic sort of space. And then an audio starts and you're with that person who's talking for 13 minutes and then you leave. And I thought, I'm going to make one every year until I die. And it's sort of like, because I know initially as a sort of younger writer, I thought that plays were all about words, you know, that they were all about sort of character and all that type of thing. And I don't think like that anymore. But these rooms allow me to still think like that. That is what it is about, sort of like meeting strangers. So it's a real indulgence for me to sort of to write something that is just words and to work with just, you know, like in this sort of confessional way with just sort of one actor.
So how does it work for the audience then? How do they interact with it?
You just walk in and you sit down.
On your own or would you be in a bit of a group?
I think there's four. So I did a hotel room. I did a little crappy hotel room. I did a kitchen. I did a bathroom. I did a girl's bedroom. And this year I've done an office with Donal O'Kelly. And people love them. I mean, they're a very, very intense sort of experience. And I love making them. I mean, they're tiny little sort of short stories.
Enda Walsh with Keelan Shanley last Sunday morning. The academic and writer Jane Hawking was Ryan Tubridy's guest on Tuesday. And inevitably, the conversation focused on her life with the renowned physicist Stephen Hawking, who died 4 months ago. Jane says she realised early on that there were several partners in her marriage: Stephen and herself, motor neuron disease, the goddess of physics, and his fame, which she says attracted all sorts of people she could well have done without.
You were married to Stephen Hawking for 30 years. You separated after 25 years, he leaving you for his nurse, Elaine Mason. But I understand, despite how difficult that must have been for you and the children at the time, you all became friends with the passage of time. Is that right, Jane?
The passage of time after Stephen's divorce from Elaine Mason, we were then able to take up a civilised relationship again. It had been very difficult for my youngest son, Tim, because Stephen was almost demanding custody of Tim, and I was terribly afraid that they could put up a very good case because they were terribly wealthy, etc. However, the best thing was to agree to let Tim go and spend one or two afternoons or evenings a week. He was only 10, for heaven's sakes, with Stephen and his new wife. And so Tim rather suffered from that. But after the marriage, we were all able to communicate again with Stephen. We were able to have a family relationship. And I regarded that as terribly important for myself, because Stephen, for me, had been more than just a husband. He'd been a very different husband. But he was somebody I was so intimately concerned for. But also for the children. I thought it was terribly important for the children and for Stephen to be able to do things together again. And that was wonderful. We had parties together. We spent Christmas together. And I would go and see Stephen probably once a week or once a fortnight just to check up and see how things were.
How did you feel when you heard the news that he died in March?
Shattered. I'd been with him that afternoon. And his health was failing. And about 3:15 in the morning, Tim called me and he said, "Mum, Dad's died." I'm sorry, I can't talk about that anymore.
It's very recent, and I totally understand that, yes. Jane.
Jane Hawking with Ryan Tubridy. In last week's documentary on One, Blonde Hair, Blue Eyes, Donal O'Herlihy and Liam O'Brien told the story of an extraordinary 9-day period in 2013 when a 4-year-old child with fair colouring was removed from a Roma camp near Athens. And just days later, two other children, both with blonde hair and blue eyes, were removed from their rightful parents by Irish authorities. One of these children was a 7-year-old girl who lived in the Dublin suburb of Talla. Emily Logan, the former children's ombudsman, compiled a comprehensive report into the events a year later, and she spoke with a little girl as part of it, who explained the impact the events had on her.
She was very complimentary about the foster parents and that everybody was very kind to her, but she also described about how upset she was and how traumatised she was, to the extent that she still, at that stage, was concerned that she could be taken away from her parents, and was sitting in front of me with different colour hair, because as a 7-year-old child, she was now dyeing her hair. She was blonde and her hair is now dark brown. She was also quite incredible the day we met with the Minister for Justice. The subsequent Minister for Justice, Frances Fitzgerald, was the person who met with me to apologise to the family on behalf of the state. And the 7-year-old girl was in the room, spoke about how she could speak 5 languages, including Irish. What was also very interesting from her point of view, or from my point of view, was to hear her say, "But nobody asked me. Nobody asked me. Was this my mother and father? Nobody asked me."
And you can listen back to that entire documentary, Blonde Hair, Blue Eyes, on the Documentary on One mobile app or website. Award-winning film composer and arranger Brian Byrne is back home in Ireland at the moment from Los Angeles. He's in rehearsal with the RTÉ National Symphony Orchestra at the National Concert Hall for Swingin' with the Symphony next Friday night. Brian knows all about keeping time with the best of them.
Let me ask you, Brian, about sitting in a studio and having to mind the music while looking at Barbara Streisand in the eye.
Yeah.
How's that for pressure for the man from Navan?
Doing these types of concerts where you're working with singers and you're working with the unpredictable and you're working with, you know, pressure, that gave me a huge amount of experience. I was doing those swinging shows for 10 years, you know, and I would arrange all these kind of jazz songs. And I got the opportunity to work with Barbara Streisand live with Alan and Marilyn Bergman. They're famous songwriters. They wrote all her big hits, The Way We Were, Yentl. They kind of became my grandparents when I moved to Los Angeles. It really took me under their wing. And I would write songs for the trunk. And I'd say, "What do you think of this one?" They're, and I had this song that I'd sent to them really early on, and they filed it away. I'd lost it. My hard drive died. And Alan Bergman, who's Barbara Streisand's main lyricist, said, "Listen, do you remember that little waltz tune that you wrote? Barbara wants to record this." And I'm like, "Alan, I can't remember the tune. I don't have the hard drive anymore." And he goes, "Well, I've filed it away." He's old school.
Yeah.
Pulled it out and he goes, "Go away and orchestrate that and we'll see you in the studio, you know, the Barbara Streisand scoring stage in Los Angeles." So I turned up and I was meant to have 2 hours with her, with the orchestra. And when I got there, one of my favourite arrangers, I won't mention his name, was getting roasted on a spit. She was just tearing stripes off him. Change the strings, change the brass. This is wrong, this is wrong. And I'm sitting there going, "Oh my God.
You're next.
I'm next.
You're next."
And I get up, meant to have 2 hours, and I get up with 27 minutes on the clock to conduct live. She's going to sing this for the first time. So I give the downbeat and I give the introduction and I think I'm doing great. And I point, "Sing, Barbara, sing." And she misses her cue and she comes in the wrong place. And it's like, we're out. And if you're out by a beat, if you're out by a bar, it's going to sound like cacophony and horrible, you know. We get to her and she goes, "There's something wrong with this arrangement." And I'm going, "Oh, yeah, here we go.
You're so, the problem, Barbara." So well, did you take her on? What did you say?
I said, "Well, let's go again." And we did it again. And the same thing happened. She came in the wrong place. And I'm literally left with 5 minutes on the clock. The song is 4.5 minutes. And I said, "Barbara, would you mind if I just do it with the orchestra? And then we'll put your vocal on later." And she goes, "That's a great idea." So I conducted, play it through, and the orchestra played it first time, and I get the old
hand clap. Thank goodness.
But
okay.
She was amazing, because she's a tough lady, but tough for the right reason, you know.
She's a perfectionist.
Oh, perfectionist, and just amazing to. And then she would call me up. She was doing a movie. I'd be at the playground of my kid, and I'd get a call, and "Barbara would like to speak to you." And she's like, "Brian, now, what are we going to do about Chorus 2? Can we, you know?" And I'm like, watching that the kid doesn't fall off the slide. "Hold on a sec, Barbara's trying to sound on the phone." He's like,
"That's the world you live in now.
It's a long way from Navan."
Brian Byrne with Ryan Tuberty on Wednesday. If you were listening to Liveline on Tuesday, the discussion ranged from the do not resuscitate policy to living wills to assisted suicide. And you may have heard one listener, Joan, telling the really moving story of her late brother Sean. Sean was in his 20s when he had a freak swimming accident which left him a paraplegic, and she told Joe how Sean grieved for his old life and at night time would often beg her to help him end his life. Well, on Wednesday, Brian Kavanagh contacted Joe. He'd had a rugby accident and spent time in the same ward as Sean at the rehabilitation centre in Dún Laoghaire in Dublin, and he had very fond memories of him.
There were a lot of sleepless nights, and we'd chat away about growing up and music and family. And of course, he mentioned Joan several times and Frank, his brother-in-law, that he loved dearly, and his family. Mm. But when I got on my feet, I suppose, after about 2 months, I'd give Sean a hand in whatever way I could, okay. You know, scratching his nose or give him a drink of water. He was very, very disabled and challenged, as Joan said. Like, if he was sitting up, for example, in a specialised wheelchair and began to find himself slipping to one side, he couldn't hoosh himself back up. Yeah. Now, he was also very, very articulate, charming guy and great company, and asked about me and the other patients all the time when, you know, his own situation was as bad as it was. But one of the things, anyway, Joe, I did was he received letters and cards from well-wishers. He hadn't the physical ability, obviously, to lift a card or open an envelope. So he let me into his conference maybe to open these letters and read them out to him.
Okay.
And one letter that maybe frequently came along was from a Rosemary.
Right.
And Rosemary, as it turned out, was a student in Trinity College who spent her time or holidays there during the summer as a nurse's aide and got to know Sean at that time. And Rosemary would write these letters. Now, my role was to read them out, but I was quite infatuated by them. It was lovely poems and books she had read and general chit-chat, and there's always nice drawings in the margin. But one day I came along to Sean. I think I was going to help wheel him down to rehab. And this lady was sitting on the bed, and it was Rosemary that Sean introduced me to. Rosemary and I are now married 43 years Monday.
It's incredible. Joan is back on the line. Stay there, Brian. Joan.
Thank you, Joan.
Hi. Hi, Joe. God, that's wonderful to hear. That's one good legacy he left anyway. I'm delighted. I do remember Rosemary, and I do remember you, Brian, because I was very... not envious of you. I just was so, we were so sad. Yeah. And we knew you were going to get better.
Yes.
And Sean wasn't, because they told us completely severed the spine. There was nothing for us. Yeah. And like, we looked around, we probably won't even remember how sad we were, looking at everybody else and thinking, my God, this is our Sean. That's the way it's going to be forever.
From Liveline with Joe Duffy on Wednesday. On Brenda Donoghue's series, Like Family, Brenda visited a young couple, Martin and Evie Nevin, in Clonakilty, County Cork. They were teenage sweethearts, and Evie was diagnosed with a genetic condition called Ehlers-Danlos syndrome when she was pregnant with their eldest child, Alex. They also have a daughter, Olivia. Martin cares for all three, and despite the challenges, it's a house with plenty of fun and laughter.
I have a tendency to play it lightheartedly. Like when you're living with so many things that are going wrong in the house, it's very easy for everybody to be a ball of misery and depression. So I try to joke around a lot and just be a messer and keep things lighthearted, because I can't stand seeing them upset. Like, so anytime I see tears, I'll try to crack some sort of a bad joke or a dad joke or something to just something to keep everything lighthearted, because like, you can deal with the symptoms while trying not to let them drag you down. So
yeah.
That's like, you do come across as very happy, kind of go-lucky people, but there's a lot of seriousness there. But we just try to keep things light and fun as best you can.
I imagine with the condition, with you trying to work, you know, Evie, you're in pain, that then you have to go, oh my God, I have to focus on a relationship as well.
Yeah.
Sometimes it kind of almost feels like, you know, just two people who live together rather than then a married couple. But then he does something really, really sweet, or says something really sweet, or I say something really nice, and kind of, you know, so we have our moments.
There's playful flirting always there, like, so.
Yeah.
So my big gestures might be out the window for apart from special occasions. There's always playful banter and flirting going on. Just a little reminder, though. Yeah. We're still a couple at the end of the day, like, you know, so.
That's Martin Nevin, one of 200,000 family carers who, between them, provided more than 6 million hours of care this week. Dearest Old Darling is the title of a monologue written by Mary Kenny and performed by the actor and writer Jean-Anne Crowley, which will headline at the Clifton Arts Festival next September. It draws on letters written from prison by Constance Markovich to her sister, the poet and pacifist Eva Gore Booth. Both Mary Kenny and Jean-Anne Crowley were Miriam O'Callaghan's guests yesterday.
I mentioned, obviously, the role of Constance Markievicz in the Easter Rising, but tell us a little bit more about her and how these letters to her sister came to light.
The letters were published, actually, in the 1980s, but my sister, Ursula, died in New York in 2003, and I found a copy of these letters among her books. Now, Ursula was not by any means an Irish nationalist. She was far more interested in the arts, and she wasn't a particular feminist either, but I think she had a great interest in prisoners, and these are prison letters, essentially. And so I started to read them, and I thought they're very touching because they show a very different side of Constance Markievicz. She was a militant Republican, and she was a very dramatic person and played such a central role in the 1916 Rising. But she did have this other side, which she reveals very much to her beloved sister, her a love of gardening, of dogs, feminine things like embroidery, all kinds of domestic arts, if you like, and of course painting and poetry. So I thought it's nice to see people in the round and see, you know, different aspects of their personality. And I thought it would make a very good monologue because this is the centenary, of course, of Constance being elected as the first woman to the House of Commons.
So did she write to her sister mainly about more personal content, Mary, or were they also politically fueled?
Well, there were political allusions, but of course her letters were censored. But the other thing is that Eva, of course, was a pacifist. She was. She lived with her woman companion, Esther Roper, in Manchester. She was a very fine poet and gentle soul. And I think Constance sort of reined in a little bit her more militant political side. I think she wanted to kind of protect Eva. And she did say at the end of her life, you know, when Eva died, which was devastating for her, you know, that she brought out the best in me and that she brought out maybe a more peaceful side.
And Jeanne, you dress and you speak like Constance while you're on the stage doing this. Do you feel as though when you're doing that, you're channeling her? And you're going to read a piece for us now as well, Jeanne.
I'll just read the first letter from the show, which is to her sister. Dearest old darling, I knew you'd try and see me, even though I'd been fighting, and I know you hate fighting and think killing is wrong. But, dearest old darling, what must be... And Mountjoy Prison is the wellspring of a new life and a new resurrection. To have been part of these events, to be a woman at the heart of the Citizens' Army, to walk in military uniform, to engage in the fight against Ireland's oppressor, what a privilege. I was so proud, and so proud of my Fianna boys, those young lads I'd trained up myself to be military men. Go at it, boys, I shouted. The Citizens' Army is taking over Stephen's Green. Oh, those stirring words. Imperishable? We declare the right of the people of Ireland to the ownership of Ireland and to the unfettered control of Irish destiny. Who wouldn't die for that aspiration?
Jeanne Crowley with an extract from Dearest Old Darling, heard on Today with Miriam yesterday. But I leave you now with a song from Nathan Carter, who joined Ray D'Arcy live in Carrick and Shannon on Thursday. Guramago Vasur Goluder, Tasulam Gurwanchev, Salta Saglar, Agus Gameshev Lum, Takanamakena, and Tachtan Johogin. Gijishin, Gijeshev Slan.
Headed down south to the land of the pines, and thumbing my way to North Carolina. Staring up the road, pray to God I see headlights. I made it down the coast in 17 hours. I picked me a bouquet of dogwood flowers. I'm hoping for Alice so I can see my baby tonight. Let's go! So rock me, mama, like a wagon wheel. Rock